Oh, the many unintended and unhappy consequences that can surface when governments presume to help. Slamming economy shut, followed by printing and distributing trillions in cash, led to skyrocketing prices. Who knew? Then, some investors and banks took some of those trillions and parked them in long-duration bonds, hoping to squeeze out just a little more yield. But then, the Fed aggressively raised interest rates to extinguish the inflation fires. This led to epic declines in the market value of the very long-duration bonds those investors and banks just bought. Who knew? Finally, some banks that overallocated to those long bonds then faced ratings downgrades, depositor anxiety, runs on their cash, and finally bank failure. Again, who knew? Stay tuned as the RLS boys examine the what, how, and why of the second largest bank failure in history right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Lungani, here as always. I say as always, although I missed last week, but we've got the gang together again. We've got Adrian Nicholson and Eric Olson. Adrian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm happy you're back, Roshan. Learned anything good while you were out or anything that you want to share before we get started in today's episode?
Nothing that really applies to today's topic, which I'm definitely excited to jump into. Before we start that off, though, Eric, how are you doing? How's your week been?
Been a great week. I'll save the details for later, but I'm glad that we're addressing this topic, which is a little bit of a pivot for us.
Yeah, it is. We had different plans in place, and then Silicon Valley Bank decided to fail. So we changed our plan for this week, and we're going to talk about them. I think it's really important for our listeners to understand what's going on, so you can be comfortable with your cash and potentially look to try to view this as an opportunity. So I was fascinated from the story at the beginning, and you know, there we're on the East Coast in Virginia, and you know, Silicon Valley Bank's all the way out on the other side of the country, and so I was reading it just as if it were news until I got a call from a client who's runs a startup company and said, "What does this mean to me? All my money for the business is in this bank." So I started digging deep and was communicating with them, all throughout the weekend. So I've been interested in this story, but I think for everyone listening, and Adrian brought up a great point at the beginning, saying people are just concerned initially, thinking about how is my money okay in the bank. So I think we start off just addressing that, and Adrian, I'll let you take that part away, since it was something you've seen a lot of.
Yeah, of course, and that example that you just gave of that person saying they're concerned for their money, that just really paints a really intense picture, because when you're hearing stuff like a bank going under, bank runs, that's just very concerning and scared, and makes you really think about the overall situation you're in right now. And that was one of the biggest things that really caused this bank to go under, where people are concerned, they want to pull their money out, and this bank isn't able to match and have the liquidity to meet these withdrawals. And I think that's just really concerning too, because these people have businesses, and if they don't have the necessary liquidity and money to run their businesses, then it's really just a trickle-down effect and really impacts a lot of the economy and then the markets as a whole. Because one thing that we always talked about before, markets just hate uncertainty. And if you're uncertain whether or not you can get to your money, that's just really a mix of bad things all going on right now. So we're just going to address what happened, how it happened, and really talked about what you as a listener and viewer should really be aware of in the next couple of days and how you should react going forward.
Yeah, and you touched on a lot of things. The first one, though, is people concerned about their money in banks. The FDIC insures you up to $250,000. So if you've got less than that at a bank, you should be fine. Going further, if you've got more than that at a bank, you can look at the bank it's at. Is it a, how big's the bank itself? And how comfortable do you feel having greater than $250,000 there? If you don't feel comfortable with that, you can move the money. So Adrian, you mentioned a bank run at Silicon Valley Bank. And what a bank run is when customers all try to pull their money out at the same time. So with Silicon Valley Bank, that was a major part of what happened to cause them to decline. $42 billion was withdrawn in a day. That's about a quarter, greater than a quarter of their deposits. So that's a big part of the decline or the closure, them being shutting down, being taken over. They had other risks as well that as far as what happened and why this happened. They told investors they needed to raise $2 billion in capital on Wednesday. Then Thursday is when all that money was taken out. They also were one of the highest, they had the highest percentage of uninsured deposits at the bank, meaning balances over $250,000. That was 97% of their deposits. They had a lot of things that uniquely positioned them to be at risk, which we'll go a little bit deeper in. But do either of you, Eric, I'll ask you, do you have anything to add if someone calls you and says, Eric, I'm concerned about my money at a bank. Let's assume their money's wasn't at Silicon Valley. And they call you up and say, Eric, I'm worried. I've got money at the bank. How do you address that problem?
Well, I had such a call just yesterday. So the answer is that I want to expand on the $250,000 FDIC insurance coverage. That's per depositor. I want to clarify that. That's per depositor. So if you hold let's say you're married and you jointly have an ownership of an account, you're each deemed to be a depositor. And as a result, the coverage, the FDIC insurance coverage on that account with that bank is $500,000, two times the $250,000. If you also then have a different ownership, perhaps you have it in an IRA, that's a different, deemed as a different depositor. And so that would be another $250,000, or you have a Roth IRA, that's a different depositor. So now some banks will tell you that it's per Social Security number. And if that's their policy and you just have a level of discomfort with that, then you might want to make some adjustments there. But the simple solution is then to make deposits in different banks. And some of you are maybe thinking, well, gee, what a hassle that is. And I'm talking about that subset of our listeners that have $1 million or $2 million or what have you in cash, some large number. In that case, you have the option of using what are considered or understood as bank deposit programs. So, for example, I'm not advertising ours. I'm just reporting that we have it. One of our primary custodians has a program in place that if you have X amount of cash in the account, they recognize for you that that is indeed a risk. And so they will just spread that cash out to a number of affiliated banks, or at least banks that with which they have a contract to do this, so that you don't have more than, actually, I think it's $243,000, because they recognize there might be some interest payments coming into it, $243,000 with any depositor. And there are other programs of that nature that we can talk about that will also help you, stay getting these attractive rates that cash is paying right now in high yield savings accounts, but ones that are FDIC insured.
Yeah. And Eric, the great point on saying that's per depositor and that you can move your money as needed. There's also in your investment account. So if you've got it in a bank and you move it to a brokerage account, there's SIPC coverage available as well if you were to do that change. Not the same thing, but it is insured, and it is another way to have additional insurance in your account. I was trying to look up what percentage of people keep over $250,000 in their bank account. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find that number, but the data that I was able to find that had things like average account balances and so on seems to indicate that it's a single digit percentage of people that have that greater than that in their bank.
Mm-hmm. And just understanding what insurance, what programs there are that are out there is really where you should just begin with your research here, seeing how you're protected. If this overall just situation happens to you, it's just extremely important to know what options are available out there for you. And we should also just mention and just address what another reason why Silicon Valley Bank really was impacted. Yes, one of the major issues were that people were asking to withdraw their money from the bank. So that caused the bank having to sell, having to just draw all this liquidity to meet this demand. And that's just really hard to do because Roshan mentioned there was just so much money being asked to withdraw. Another big thing that impacted this Silicon Valley Bank was overall just the positions that they had on their balance sheets were really impacted by higher interest rates because a lot of what they had were these bonds, these long-term bonds that had decent rates a couple of years ago. But as we know, since interest rates have been climbing higher and higher, this really impacted a lot of their bond prices that they had. So that was something that really impacted, let's just say, the investments that this bank had. With higher interest rates, the investments that they had just began to decline. So it was really bank run and their bonds really getting impact, which really caused this bank to go under. And I think the biggest lesson really that you have to draw from this is just understanding what we talked about before, just the importance of diversification and what are going to be the biggest risk to your overall portfolio and situation. In this bank's case, it was interest rate risk that really impacted them. So just really understanding from an individual perspective what risks are out there that could really impact your overall situation is a really important lesson you can draw from this as well.
I'd like to go into further detail on how Silicon Valley Bank was almost uniquely positioned to be caught into something like this. So just taking a step back and looking at what they do in the history of this bank, yeah, they were known by many as the startup bank. So they had a lot of their money late in the 2020, you know, COVID stimulus. There was more deposits coming in general. You also had, with the low interest rates, you had a lot of venture capital activity going on. There were companies going public. There were SPACs. And Silicon Valley Bank liked to cater to these type of depositors. So, Adrian, you mentioned interest rate and the interest rate risk. Well, in 2021, Silicon Valley Bank doubled their deposits. Right in that year, right, their deposits doubled. In addition to that, because they're lending money to these businesses, because they're catering to these businesses that are bringing in equity capital, or those businesses, one, don't necessarily need loans. Because what does a bank usually do? They take money in, they lend it out, right? Well, their customers aren't necessarily needing those loans. So they've got all of a sudden all this money coming in, they're trying to put it into something they view as safe. So they're looking at treasuries and they're thinking, well, let me do long-term treasuries because you're really getting zero on the short-term treasuries back then. So they then go to long-term treasuries to make a little bit more money.
Yeah, it was actually a little worse than that. They didn't go to treasuries mostly. They went to residential-backed mortgage securities and commercial-backed mortgage securities, which they thought would provide them with a higher yield than they could get on treasuries so that they would have that interest. So they didn't even really have the level of security, at least across that entire pool of assets that they deployed into these longer-dated bonds, as you would have had from treasuries.
They pose the similar issue, right?
Oh, for sure do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I get your point that they're even riskier than treasuries, but even the treasuries would have been a problem for them. And I know they had a part of their portfolio, at least a significant part, in the long dated treasuries. I'm trying to look up the amount.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, some amount. So let me just back up and backfill even on something that you said. So you said, for example, the deposits doubled into this bank. Why did they double into this bank? Why? How does that happen that a bank in 1 year's time doubles? Well, what preceded that? Two things. Number one, what preceded 2021? What preceded moving from roughly $100 billion of deposits to $200 billion of deposits in 1 year? No businesses grow like that just out of randomly. So the two things were that when you have a zero interest rate policy, what sort of investment does that encourage? Well, essentially it encourages investing in things that will pay off far into the future because there's really no opportunity. A dollar today is considered more or less equivalent to a dollar in the future. So you can spend 10 years, if you wish to, developing some, you know, extremely detailed, robust, let's use, since this has been in the news lately, artificial intelligence, and then have a big payday, you know, 20 years from now. That's fine. But when interest rates are high and there's an opportunity cost of that, now you're interested in current cash flow. So with that kind of an interest rate environment, it favors people saying, I'm going to bet on more speculative things that won't have a payoff until the future. Who's involved in speculative things? Venture capitalists and startups. And what's more is a lot of these venture capitalist firms, the big firms that come in with the capital for the startups themselves, the entrepreneurs themselves, in some cases reportedly required their startups to keep their cash on hand at SVB Bank. So you have all this flood of money going in a zero interest rate environment to these more speculative things. What's the bank to do? It's not like they're their local savings and loan. The other thing is that the flood of money that came out of the doors of the federal government in the wake of COVID also had to go someplace. And so one of the things that produced among other things was investors saying, okay, well, let's deploy some of this cash. And they point it toward these venture capitalists. It was a giant year for venture capital in 2021. So combination of really low interest rates and combination of the fuel being added to the fire, if you will, through spewing all this money out of the federal government, was sort of like the perfect storm that would set up this massive increase in deposits with no way to profitably deploy it except to put it into bonds. And longer dated bonds at the time were paying better than short dated bonds. The issue is that if someone needs money and then interest rates start to rise, what happens, we've said this many times for you, our listener, that there's an inverse relationship between bond prices and bond interest rates. As interest rates rise, the value of those bonds, or at least the price of those bonds, fall. And what SVB Bank wanted to do was to say, well, let's treat these as if they're on our books at the value at which they'll eventually mature. But that's not really how it works, because if they had to sell them, what's called mark-to-market, then they would not be worth the value that they would be at maturity. Instead, they would be at a diminished value. And so as a result, what you're left with is when they started having that call on deposits more than they could satisfy, and they started to answer them, they realized, okay, we've got to sell. They sold $20 billion, $21 billion of bonds. And when they did that, then they realized, geez, we sold them for less than they would have been worth at maturity, but we had to do it. So they went out and they made a capital. They tried to sell stock. And the minute they tried to sell $2 billion worth of stock to raise additional equity for all of this, all the VCs in the area that had been using them started dialing up their startups and dialing up the entire community and say, you better pull your deposits. Something's not right there. And so talk about a swift move, 44 hours, I think it was, between the time they announced their $2 million, their intent to raise $2 million and the time they're shut down. That is lightning fast.
It is. I'd add a couple things just to what you said. One is those treasury part of the portfolio, they're allowed to hold them, have them as held to maturity. I just don't want it to seem like they were doing some kind of fraudulent accounting stuff. They didn't break any accounting rules. They're allowed to do that. Before they went to raise capital too, they went to sell their $21 billion bond portfolio to raise cash, and they took a $1.8 billion loss. So you had a lot of warning signs that happened, but all those warning signs. At most, you could say we're in the first quarter. The earliest signs I was seeing of any concern of them was after their January, after their announcement, their earnings for the fourth quarter came out. They weren't downgraded, but I had heard that they were starting to hear about potentially being downgraded. I believe it was by Moody's, and it was by Moody's, and Moody's was then supposed said that they were, that SVB was at a high risk of downgrade due to significant unrealized losses in early March. So you have at the beginning of March all these things starting to come together, and I believe that risk of downgrade is what led to that bond sale, which then led to the equity raise. So you've got all these things happen in just a matter of days.
Mm-hmm. So I think this would be a really good time to compare and contrast, if there are any, to what happened in 2008, because now that is being talked about as well today. Is this going to be another 08? What are the similarities? What are the differences? And we're bringing up a lot of things that really overlap here, and we can really address them. Whereas today, with Silicon Valley Bank going down, we mentioned that it's just a perfect storm of investments losing value, people pulling money out of the bank. Where if you draw back in 2008, there was a lot of fraudulent stuff that was happening, where we were just talking about rating agencies giving these certain institutions and these investments really good scores, when in reality, if you pull back the layers, it was a lot worse than that. And you had also different types of regulations that have come along the way that really require certain banks to meet liquidity standards that weren't really present in 2008, if at all. So a lot really has changed, but what would you guys want to start with comparing when people are expecting, is this going to be another 08 or is it different this time? What would be your initial thoughts on this?
I'll say it's very different in one critical respect, which you've already identified, Adrian, and that is that this was not an issue of credit risk. It wasn't that SVB put money into risky assets, and for that matter, I would say this, the same is true of Signature Bank. The asset quality is relatively good. The issue is that it was interest rate risk in this instance that has precipitated this. When the Federal Reserve steps on the gas pedal and raises rates at this pace, the fastest ever, from basically 0 to 0.25% to in the neighborhood of 4.5% in such a very short period of time, that throws every one of these bond portfolios for a tremendous, tremendous loop. Just in the same way that any investor who had a bond component to their portfolios last year saw the decline in for example, the Barclay or Bloomberg, aggregate bond index declined somewhere in the order of 10% even after some sort of recovery toward later in the year. When that happens, you have that kind of loss, of course it's going to spell trouble for these banks.
Yeah, and what's interesting is I at the beginning of this cycle, I was reading a lot about how there's an opportunity in banks because with higher rates, they can get a bigger spread for interest they pay versus what they loan out. But bank stocks haven't picked up with rates, and we're seeing right now with the problem, with the existing portfolios they have, losing value. I think it's very different from 08. So just a couple data points. In 08, there were $23 of deposit liabilities for liquid cash before. And with regulatory changes now, it's only 5 to 6 times. So the banks have more cash. In 08, now they have more of their assets in treasuries as well than they did in 08. Compared to 08, this was a credit problem, right? Where they had made riskier loans. So they had more percentage of riskier loans on their books than they had safer assets. That's very different. And the most important point right now, I think, is this difference is this time the problem is liquidity and duration, which is interest rate risk, versus the problem being loan defaults on loans they've already made. So I think there's a lot of differences where this is not an 08 type problem. And I also think the Fed did a good job of reacting quickly, or the Treasury, excuse me, the FDIC, that they did a great job in reacting quickly from bank collapse on Friday, you know, immediately saying, okay, depositors will have access to at least the 250 by Monday. And then before Monday's open on the market, they had said, actually, we're going to guarantee the depositors money.
So the program that was put in place then over the weekend, which I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I wouldn't want to see a panic, and I wouldn't want to see a run on all banks. And part of what we're doing, along with, you know, hundreds and thousands potentially of other podcasters and other shows, is trying to talk about this issue so as to have a rational perspective about all of this and not allow a panic to set in. But what the feds did was to say, all right, here's what we'll do. We recognize that mark-to-market pricing of the bonds on banks like Silicon Valley Bank were lower than the value that those bonds would have if held to maturity. We get that. Here's what we're going to do if you run into a liquidity problem because of, for one reason or another. We will lend you money on a short-term basis for up to a year. We'll lend you money equal not to merely the level that your bond holdings are now on a mark-to-market basis. Instead, we'll lend you money up to the level that they are on a face value basis. So that, in this instance, had this existed just prior to all of this, Silicon Valley Bank could have gone to the feds and said, hey, we're getting some calls for, you know, deposits. Could you lend us up to $200 billion. We've got all these, we've got all these bonds, at least up to the value of our bonds. Could you lend us enough to get us through this for the coming year? And I think, I mean, as much as I hold my nose in the face of that, because I just really have a visceral reaction against government constantly involving itself in the private sector. I think many of these problems are precipitated by government involving itself in the private sector and the intervention in interest rates and all the rest that we've talked about in previous episodes. Nevertheless, in this case, I would say, had they not done that, and had they, that it's a very elegant solution to have said, we'll back that so as to allow investors to have their fears calmed.
Yeah, so that program, for anyone that's looking into it or researching it, is the Bank Term Funding Program that Eric just mentioned. And I think in a few years from now, there are going to be headlines about the profits they made on it because, you know, they're charging interest on this loan. And I do think that'll be very much a political spin, by the way. So I'm not necessarily using that as a way to say this is a good program. At the same time, I do think this is a good program and they had no option. I view what's going on now is another one of the unintended consequences of excessive COVID stimulus. And what I mean by that is that's really what led to a lot of the inflation issues that we're having now. And then, so then now the hands being forced to the Fed, you've got to raise rates. And then now this is the next layer of an unintended consequence of raising rates, causing the long-term treasuries to decline in value, or long-term bonds in general, I should say, to decline in value. And then if people are pulling their money out of banks and they've got these long-term treasuries, and I keep saying treasuries just because if you consider from the bank's perspective, they're viewed as the safest assets. Now they have very sophisticated models to manage their risk. One of the issues with Silicon Valley Bank, I don't know how much has contributed to it or not, but it definitely got a lot of news in the press, is that they did not have a chief risk officer for almost a full year. I think if I remember correctly, it was April of last year, 2022, till January, where they didn't have one. So I'm not absolving them for not seeing the risk. At the same time, I'm not taking the government's role out of this in terms of the rate hikes helping lead to this.
Yeah, well, I would say, just to pile on a little bit more, it's the, as you said, it's all that excessive COVID stimulus. It's also shutting things down so that the supply chains were so disrupted. And that's, I don't lay that at the feet strictly of the U.S. government, because that was a worldwide action on the part of governments. But nevertheless, when you put, you basically distort the supply demand dynamics of a global economy, and then you also flood it with a lot of cash to chase things that it's very difficult for some companies to produce under those conditions. What are you going to get? You're going to get inflation. We got inflation. Then you have to try to stamp it out with, as I believe, money supply constraint is the best approach. They've been using interest rates instead, although I acknowledge their money supply is coming down. But yeah, what a mess. So here's what I would say, though, is a lesson for people who are thinking about, well, where would I put my money? And we're actually going to be talking to some venture capitalists or some heads of some venture capital funds and in a few episodes ahead. But the and maybe we'll talk about this, because I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, they'll have some stories to tell about what it was that are the sort of industry dynamics that lead to those sorts of deposits at a place like Silicon Valley Bank. But one thing is that it probably isn't advisable for a bank to have such a deep sector concentration. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, as we've already talked about its concentration, the same thing is true in Signature Bank, which is very deeply involved in the New York real estate market. And so if you have that, you're vulnerable to sort of a herd mentality within that sector, that industry, and that affected both of them. The second thing I think is a reason for diversification is that, as we talked about before, had there been just basic ways of the bank making money from lending, not just from placing investments into bonds, but actually through lending, then I think you had a different sort of income stream, and you would have potentially had some more liquidity. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, if I'm not mistaken, they had only about a quarter of their total asset base was liquid, whereas a typical bank might have, and I'm not, this isn't quite precise, but typically about half of it. So the fact that they allowed themselves to get to such an illiquid position to begin with is a management issue. And the CFO, you have to wonder how, or as maybe it should have been the risk officer, Roshan, as you pointed out, how did they get to the point where they allowed themselves to have so little liquidity? The second thing is the mismatch between long-dated investments and short-dated liquidity requirements. Why wouldn't you match short with short, long with long, instead of matching short obligations with long investment commitments? That also seems really strange and puzzling.
So a little bit more about that, to address both of those things, I've got some numbers for you. One, they had $74 billion in loans and $120 billion in investment securities. And the securities were 56% of their assets. Compared that to a Bank of America, which is 28%. So that's one thing. The next thing, I think it's unfortunately a simple answer to why you don't match short with short and long with long, or a little more detailed on the answer at first, is they're catering to a lot of these firms that are putting in these big deposits when they get capital come in, but that money's not going to stay there. They need to withdraw it. They need to pay salaries. You know, they need to expand their business. And I think what the bank simply did was they tried to make a little bit more money, right? So you can call it greed, but that's why they went towards the longer duration or the mortgage backs versus treasuries, is they were trying to make a little bit more money on what they had, and that's when they got caught in the interest rate hikes. And I was seeing somewhere that you're looking at a 15 to 20% drop on the 10-year treasuries that they would have owned. If they own longer dates, you're looking at a bigger drop. I want to explain that real further. If they went out when they got all this capital in 2021, when they doubled their deposit base, and they put it in 10-year treasuries, they were yielding 1.5%. And now, you fast forward 2 years, they're yielding 4%. Well, no investor is going to buy that treasury at face value to get 1.5% when they can get 4. So the price of the treasury goes down, and it has to drop by 15 to 20% to equate to the 4% yield. So the further out you go, the bigger drop you're taking in price.
Yeah, the 30-year treasuries, I think, dropped about 30% with that two percentage point interest increase.
And the 20s were a little higher, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not higher than the 30, but the 20s were, I believe, were a little over 30%. And that's last calendar year as well. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look back to 2021, which would have a steeper decline. So it just... think about that. You're losing a third of your portfolio value, and you've got to sell that portfolio to have people take their withdrawals now. It's no surprise they had a liquidity crunch. But Adrian, you had asked at the beginning of this section, well, how's it different from 08? I think that's just the biggest example. In 08, the banks lent money to borrowers that were defaulting. Whereas in 2023, the banks invested money in securities that have gone down in value. And if they are treasuries, you can hold them on your books as held to maturity. And that's perfectly accepted accounting convention, which means you don't have to take those losses. Well, Silicon Valley Bank had to sell to meet the depositors' demands. And so they had to take those losses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like that perfect storm that Eric mentioned. And I really like some of the concepts you're bringing up, Eric, how now more than ever, it's important just to have liquidity, diversification, because just the landscape is really changing and it's different. And it seems like it's changing every single day, where a couple of years back, low interest rates, companies are expanding, small businesses are making bigger bets. And that's just really changed over time. And just really a term that I'm, or like a sentence, I really think it's really important now that investors really need to take in consideration when it comes to their investments or investing in a specific company, is when the bill comes due right now, because that's just really important, because you don't want to get, so to speak, the floor ripped off from underneath you. As long as you have that diversification, a strong balance sheet, you have liquidity, that's very favorable in an environment that we're in today. So that really just makes investors really need to consider some of the positions that they're in right now with this high interest rate environment. Just something that really needs to be looked at. And also, just it's always going back to the Fed. How's the Fed really going to respond with this? Are they going to keep increasing interest rates? Are they going to keep them where they're at right now? Is the Fed put finally coming? That's just all stuff that people really need to bake in, just to really consider with their overall portfolio, just to see how it's gonna perform. Really,
I mean, I think that's a great transition to looking at what opportunities and risks are out there in this environment right now. Eric, did you have something to add?
Yeah, well, I guess it's just one more policy commentary. And so, and this is maybe highlighting one more difference from 2008. In 2008, some banks actually were bailed out, and the banks themselves were bailed out. In this instance, the banks themselves are not being bailed out. Instead what's happened is that the depositors are being bailed out, which is it's a subtle difference, but I think it's an important one. So in this case, Silicon Valley Bank's shareholders, the people that lent them money through bonds, they're not being made whole. It is only depositors who are being made whole. And I as much as you know we could have a debate about whether or not bailing out these institutions is a good thing or a bad thing. You know, we used it back in 2008, the notion too big to fail. And these were, as Roshan said earlier, the second and third largest bank failures in U.S. history. Washington Mutual being, I think, $308 billion when it went down in 2008. Silicon Valley Bank being just over $200 billion. And Signature Bank, if I'm not mistaken, just a little under $100 billion. You know, in the big scheme of things, I think those were bank numbers in size, at least the 16th largest and the 25th largest, thereabouts, somewhere in there, of banks in the United States. And so not insignificant banks, whatever. But I do think it is important for market participants to understand there is risk in what they do, because if there's a notion in insurance that's known as moral hazard. Moral hazard is a concept that once you get an insurance policy, you tend to be willing to do riskier things. If just the most extreme example, you get car insurance, maybe you drive a little more recklessly. Not you, Adrian, because I know you've got those sweet new that sweet new ride, and so you're not going to do anything irresponsible with that. But you know, things of that nature, or you have a certain sort of health coverage, so maybe you just say, "Well, I can eat more poorly or never exercise or something of that nature." So the moral hazard here in society and the economy, I think, needs to be something that we attempt to limit as much as possible, so that people in business. People understand the risk and they take risk into account in the decisions that they make, rather than thinking, it'll be okay, they'll save us. Here, the banks were not saved.
You make a very good point, but I also think that it's just worth noting it was a different problem, right? Back then versus now. I think if you don't bail out the banks back then, you are looking at a U.S. financial systematic collapse of the collapse of the banking system. Whereas now, if you don't bail out the depositors, you're actually dealing with something similar in terms of a collapse. But it's because of the run on the bank, and their solution this time is a lower cost way, right, to fix the problem.
And then regulation, like we talked about as well, with your moral hazard example, it's extremely different from 2008 versus now, because there was no regulation. So the amount of riskier bets you can make were just really the sky was the limit, where now there's a little bit tighter of a framework, but since there is more regulation now, yes, it's harder, but it still can happen. You know, these things, there's always the risk when it comes to investing within anything.
Well, opportunity and risk, I'm trying to look at this and say, okay, where can you go? And whenever we talk about things like this, we always have to give our disclosure that we're not recommending anything. This is just for conversation and debate. Speak to your advisor, do your research. If you need help, you can reach out to us on a one-on-one basis. But so I get into the office Friday, and I had plans to do one thing, and I thought, well, let me just do a bunch of research on banks, because I think there'll be an opportunity. And I can say that I didn't make any kind of moves. But the first thing that stands out from an opportunity perspective as well, the big banks are going to be winners of this. People are going to move their money and they're going to go to bigger banks. So I did have Bank of America alone says over $15 billion in deposits have come in to them over the last few days, right? So that's one of the big banks. I don't have numbers for JP Morgan, Citi, or Wells Fargo, but those stocks are down right now. So I'm not saying go out and buy those stocks or anything like that by any means. I'm saying this is a good opportunity to do your research. And I don't think unless you're looking at First Republic Bank, just the stock went nuts the last couple days. Which, you know, it's a more speculative story than the big banks are. But unless you're looking at these, what I'll call more speculative moves, I think you've got time to do your research, right? I think that this will, the bank stocks are, at least before we started recording, they're down again today. So I think you've got time to do your research and analysis to see, okay, are there opportunities in that sector or that space that you'd feel comfortable making a long-term investment in?
Yeah, the regional banks in particular, as you pointed out, so these would have been deemed to be, instead of the big money center banks, these would be deemed to be regional banks. There's a index for regional banks, and then there's the exchange-traded funds that focus on regional banks. And as just before we hit record this morning, so we're having this conversation on the Ides of March. We hit record, the markets have been open for about an hour, and regional banks were down another 2.5%, something like that. So in Europe, Credit Suisse was down, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere around 25%. So now, you know, the Europeans are thinking, okay, what's going on here? I should note, Credit Suisse, that's not just coming out of the blue. There's been some misgivings about Credit Suisse among the European banks for some period of time here now, but nevertheless, we're not out of the woods. I would say the thing we're trying to quell is panic, and you have a rational based response to what's taking place around us. But I would also, on that basis, just say, as you're saying, Roshan, sometimes the best response to a panic is to look for the opportunity.
Yeah, and I do say that. I think you, I almost naturally look towards those areas because that's where you should potentially get some pricing for securities that doesn't make sense anymore. You're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or the Buffett quote. You know, I think it's when there, you know, when there's blood in the streets, that's when you want to buy, right? Or be greedy when others are fearful. But you had mentioned, you know, the regional banks, and the first thing I'd say about the regionals, I've read a lot about how some of these smaller banks are still at risk despite the government lending program out there. In addition to that, banks' balance sheets and what they're doing can sometimes be very hard to understand. So that'd be an area where I do believe there are opportunities. I think people are going to make a lot of money in that space, but that's going to be a lot more work, specialty knowledge needed, and a lot more effort. Now, the big banks, their balance sheets are just as, or even more so, as hard to understand or to figure out what's going on, where they're invested, and so on. I'm not by any means saying they're easier. That's definitely not the case. It's just that they will have a stronger balance sheet than the regionals just by their sheer size, and then they've got they're in a position where they probably are too big to fail.
Well, I think that's true. But coming back to the bank deposit program, or the bank term deposit program, I think is what you said. I do think that will be a source of relief, or at least protection from the psychology that surrounds all of this. If people know, okay, there's going to be the ability for my bank to go borrow money up to the level of what it's not its mark to market, but what its face value positions on its bonds are, that can provide me some assurance. I will also say there, I think there's, leaving aside the banking sector per se and just the larger policy response, if we look at treasury or interest rate futures, looking at what the Fed would be expected to do today or this week at least, it was previously viewed that there's a good chance that they would go back to raising rates one more time, or you know, still again, but this time not the quarter point interest rate increase that they had done previously, but instead they would go back to the 50 cent or the 50, I mean 50 cent, why I'm saying that, that sounds like I'm a music fan or something. It's a 50 basis point or 0.5% increase in the rates. Well, suddenly with the news of all of this, what's changed is now suddenly people are saying, no. We think there's about a 0% chance that the Fed will raise by 0.5%, even though the inflation prints that came in last month weren't coming down as fast as people would have liked to see. Instead, there's maybe an increase likely of only 0.25%. And even some are saying, and I saw this Goldman Sachs was attributed as saying, that they think the Fed is going to just hold rates steady now in the wake of this, recognizing that it is this interest rate increase that has interacted with the prior decisions of these banks who bought their bonds in good faith prior to, you know, the extremely rapid rise in interest rates precipitated by the Fed. They're saying, okay, maybe what we're doing here is actually creating a bigger problem. So I don't envy the Fed right now. They I know they have a conviction about the need to raise rates in order to cool the economy, in order to cool inflation. And now they're going to perhaps wonder if they'll actually have that resolve. Isn't that interesting? I think I was saying once upon a time, I was fearful that the Fed would lack the resolve to continue to raise interest rates in the way in which they were projecting that they would. And I wonder if we're now seeing that moment has arrived.
Yeah. You know, yesterday, the markets were up over 2%. Because of exactly what you said, and they did pull back. I can't remember where they closed, but I believe they were in the 1% or a little over neighborhood. But it was purely on speculation that the Fed can no longer raise rates. So I was just watching that yesterday, and I was just surprised that okay, they shook off this whole bank failure risk in a day and shifted over to the rate policy. But it also shows you how powerful that rate policy is, right? If they're looking at shifting. So I've read multiple things, and I can't remember who it was, but there was some market prognosticator yesterday saying that they're going to pause in March, and that will actually be the last one. They were predicting that they're going to hold them steady and then cut them going forward. With the inflation numbers that came out, the print yesterday was interesting because it was in line, which gives the Fed flexibility to potentially pause or go with a lower hike. But it was bad enough where, you know, if you're not dealing with this bank crisis, it would have been a certainty that they were raising. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see which way things go in the short term. But, you know, I mentioned yesterday being up as much as it was in the markets, and then you fast forward 24 hours with the whole Credit Suisse situation and the markets are down, you know, over 1% now. So I think this volatility is going to continue for a little while, but as that Buffett quote I've mentioned many times on here, the markets will transfer wealth from the impatient to the patient. That's where, you know, talking about the banks and the opportunity, is there an opportunity in there to get in, accept the short-term volatility, be patient for the long-term, and then have a nice gain for you? That's the area to research, as I mentioned earlier. This is not advice. This is not recommendations for anything other than it may be worth your time to look into it. And there, you may come up with something, you may not. I'm finding this entire thing just fascinating with what's going on. So I've spent a ton of time looking into it. But you know, that's why we do this podcast, where we tend to be finance nerds. So
yeah, there's a lot of learning opportunity here, isn't there?
There is definitely a ton that can be taken away or learned from this, and then, you know, hopefully store that information for whenever the next such scenario arises.
Well, I have nothing more to say on this topic, except to invite people to listen to our shows coming up. I've got a little preview of a couple of our next episodes. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to reach out to us. So looking ahead to next week, we are having a venture capital fund manager. Wes Lyons is going to join us from Eagle Venture Fund. And the week after that, we're going to have David Sims from Talenton Fund. So we thought we'd give you, since we talk a lot about public markets, and we've talked from time to time about alternative investments, but usually the sorts of alternative investments we've discussed have been ones that have been much more of established companies, cash flowing companies. In this case, we're going to successively deal with more the venture, the early stage investing. This isn't angel, but this is venture capital, working with founders and really trying to coach and develop those founders, not just to lend them some cash, but really help them thrive and succeed and accomplish what they're intending to accomplish. And then we'll talk about a similar fund that's doing and some of the portfolio companies that they have invested in Africa, so that we can hear some some very interesting and stories that have a lot of contrast with the sorts of ways that we typically think about investing, where we're normally very, very distant from the actual outcomes at the corporate level. Here, we're going to hear some stories about things that are making an impact, much bringing the investor and the recipient of that investment, and then the beneficiary of what that company is doing, much, much closer together. If you have questions about what we've discussed today, though, Adrian, how do people find us, and how do people pose questions?
Our information is in the show notes. You can email us, call us, whatever your best way is for communication. We'll be happy to answer any of your questions. You can also go to our website and our YouTube channel as well, the Retirement Lifestyle Show.com. And like I mentioned before, our information's in the show notes if you want to contact us that way.
Fantastic. And if you have not done so already, you're listening for the first time, or you've just sampled an episode or two, if you like what we're bringing, then we invite you to subscribe so that you'll have us pop up in your feed on a weekly basis. And as well, if you have not rated the show, of course, if you hate the show, please don't rate the show. But if you like the show, please do give us a rating, because that will help others discover the show.
Excellent. Thank you. We look forward to being back next week. This has been another episode of the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through RHA Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither RHA Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of RHA Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through RHA Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor, and securities through RHA Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance, by Jason Shaw and Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube Audio Library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.